Welcome to radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to firehouse.com.
As sponsor of this podcast, the National Fire Sprinkler Association would like to recognize members of the fire service for their continued dedication to protecting our communities and championing the fire sprinkler initiatives at the grassroots. We are all indebted to your service.
Okay, welcome to this month's issue of Fire Marshal's Corner. My name is Ed Kamau, and we're taking a look again this month at the significant multiple fatality fires that have been happening across the country. And unfortunately, January has been a particularly tragic month for this year. Generally, we do see a spike in the winter, but this year, by far, you know, this is, I've been tracking for 3 years now. And this January, at this point, we've had 79 fire deaths in the country. And here we are just about the end of the month. And that compares to 51 in 07 and 42 in 08. So we are definitely higher than we've ever had before. And what's really tragic, too, is over 60% of those are children. So it's a problem that we've all been grappling with or trying to grapple with over the years. And we've assembled a panel of people here today that are going to really look into the various aspects of it. And we have joining us today is Chief Rubin with the D.C. Fire Department, Maine State Fire Marshal and past NASFAM President John Dean, Dr. Dennis O'Neill, who's the acting U.S. Fire Administrator, and Baltimore Fire Marshal O'Brocky, who's going to, and they're all going to, like I said, take a look at a different aspect of this problem and see if, you know, what ideas perhaps we can come up with that can help you all out there when you're looking at these kind of incidents. So I appreciate everybody joining us, and perhaps we'll just start right off with Chief Rubin from D.C., where you just recently had one of these tragedies in D.C. I believe it was five people that were killed in a fire.
Actually, Ed, we've had two. One situation on January 1st was a total of six fire fatalities, and just as you mentioned in the opening, two were adults, four were children. The day after the presidential inauguration, on the 21st of this month, we had two fatalities in a house fire. One was 70 years old. One was a bit younger. So we're following the same sort of patterns and problems that you mentioned in the opening. And it's a little unnerving. I think the community is just very, very upset and concerned about seeing so many fire fatalities in our community.
The first one that you mentioned there was at the beginning of the year. Could you maybe give us a little bit of a detail on that one with the
Absolutely. A little bit after 7 a.m. in the morning on January 1st, the alarm was received for a house fire in the northeast section of our city, very close to Catholic University. The battalion chief just happened to be backing into one of the stations that's closest to that location and was able to arrive from response. The entire response time for Battalion 1 was about 1 minute and 2 seconds. The company following him was about 4 or 5 seconds later. So I had a battalion chief and an engine company on location within 1 minute and 10 seconds. When they arrived, the fire was coming out of pretty much every window with three adults on the porch, if you will. They had climbed out on the roof of the porch, so they were at the second floor level of the home. The gentleman who was rescued by ladder indicated that there were six more folks inside, provided some pretty clear detail as to where and what we should expect. The firefighters made, without a doubt, the most valiant effort of the folks left behind. They were able to take four of the six out. We started CPR and other related support activities, transported immediately to hospital to no avail, and two folks were found later in a little different section than what was described, but they had succumbed to their injuries and were left in place. Fatalities range from age 9 or 10 to age 74.
So you had, if I got this right, nine people that were in the house at the time of the fire? Was that it?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Three families, three different families, all one extended family. But in fact, out of that nine folks, six would not survive.
I mean, obviously it wasn't sprinklered. We can assume that from the fire. How about smoke alarms? Were there working?
No, of course, no sprinklers. It was an older home, we believe, built in the 30s. Balloon frame construction added to the extension of the fire. and there were smoke detectors, but we've not been able to establish it, whether they functioned or not. On the first floor was a very, very old wired, and I seriously doubt that it was functioning. However, on the second floor, we did find a newer battery-operated alarm that perhaps did work. We haven't been able to conduct interviews with the surviving family members. In fact, we're still going through the burial process and helping them in every way that we can, and we hope to learn what happened. But either way, it wasn't very effective in notifying and getting the family out. As I mentioned, the husband, the wife, and one of the children had to escape to a porch roof to get out of the heavy, heavy fire conditions that would confront us that day.
How about the cause? Have you guys come up with a cause on it?
We did. The home had some electrical work in the past. It met no standard or specification, and it was electrical in nature. Six of the different circuit breakers had activated that day, and the fire occurred in the wall between the basement and the first floor. We're pretty sure, once again, because of the balloon frame construction and where the fire started, it burned undetected for a significant period of time. And when it finally did break through, again, it broke through at least on two floors, if not on all three. And the family was forced out to refuge immediately for the three folks to be able to basically save their own lives.
Now pick it up.
Now we're seeing a lot of these fires occurring, too. And as a matter of fact, when you look at it on a map, it's almost between D.C. heading up 95 towards New York. It seems just right along that route, with really a lot of them in Philadelphia. And I think they probably face the same sort of circumstances where you do, where it's a lot of people living close together in one building or one occupancy that really lend themselves to these type of fires. I mean, would that be fair to say it's the same thing in D.C.?
Oh, without a doubt. I think we're one of America's highest density cities. I saw a study one time, and I think we were the 14th or 15th highest density. There is a lot of people that live in our community in a very small space. Although we're pushing about 1 million residents, we only have 68 square miles for everybody to fit into. And if you'll think about the federal enclave, the various parks and monuments that are here, it's very little buildable space as compared to the population. So you're exactly right.
Yeah. I'd like to turn to John Dean now, as I mentioned, as the Maine State Fire Marshal and NASFAM past president. You know, this really isn't, as we're discussing, it certainly is not a problem limited to Washington and kind of spreads across the country, although we're definitely seeing a focus on the eastern half of the country for a lot of these fires. Is there anything you can offer us from a national perspective on these, John?
Well, as you mentioned, it doesn't look very good for us in the eastern part of the country when you look at the map where these multiple fatality fires are occurring. And I think that, as you also mentioned, it's not unique to just the denser population urban areas, because even in areas such as Maine, where I live, I was looking at some of our stats, and in the last 11 years, we've had five different fires, multiple fatality fires with 15 fatalities in them. So, and this is a fairly rural state, of course. But in looking at the causes of fires in Maine, we're looking at about a quarter of them related to cooking, but then upwards of 40% of them involving heating. And this is a year, of course, we're very concerned about it because of the cost of fuel and so on, and the wider use of space heaters and alternative energy appliances that may or may not be installed or operated properly. So, I don't think anybody's spared from being affected by this. And it seems like it just it is pretty shocking this year, I think. But it seems to have been going on forever. I'm just looking back at a. We're just passing an anniversary here of in 1945 when we had 16 children in a nursery home, and a nurse die in one fire. It's probably our worst one here in Maine. I mean, we don't get big large fatality fires here, but reading through the reports, it's involving cooking, heating, and not meeting codes and standards and so on. So. I think we've got a huge challenge ahead of us to try to get to some of these people who need the message. Right. And then even if they get the message, do they have the ability to take some action.
And you're mentioning alternative heating, and really one of the most tragic ones of this year. Well, they're all tragedies. I mean, I don't want to diminish any of them. But they had one in Philadelphia where seven people were killed in a fire that, and this is just kind of all the issues that we're going to be talking about. It was a large number of people in the building. They were down in a basement that only had one way out because they were doing renovations down there. Mm-hmm. And they were trying to refuel a kerosene heater with gasoline. And yep. The fire flashed and it took off. And add to that, too, they just recently immigrated to this country, too, from Liberia. So, you know, it's a lot of the things, and we'll be talking to Dennis about this, too, with the changing demographics that I think were right there. But I think you hit a touchstone, too, with the alternative heating issue, because we definitely see a spike in the winter on these fires.
And we've had our own. We've had a double fatality with a grandmother and a grandchild with the kerosene heater that was fueled with gasoline. And we just had an elderly gentleman have his clothes ignited, getting too close to an electric space gas-powered space heater, and mm-hmm. he died. So it's all over the place. I don't think that we're unique at all here.
And I think, you know, it's also the rural-urban issue. I mean, we're certainly seeing it in the denser urban areas, but also, I mean, we're seeing them in the rural areas, too. I remember last year, one in Kentucky, 10 people dying in a trailer fire. And I think that really compounds the problem of how do you correct it. It may be a little bit easier in a city where you have some staffing and some people in the fire department on duty and stuff. But, boy, these rural areas, it's just really problematic, I would think, reaching out to them.
Yeah. I think that, you know, the people... We've got all the low hanging fruit on getting our message of fire prevention. We've been able to do a good job. You know, we could always do better, obviously. But the people who are not getting the message now are people who are hard to get the message to. And you know, I'm sure when Dr. O'Neill talks about demographics, you know, that will play into this. But you know, even here in a state that's not considered to be, you know, really diverse here in the city of Portland, we've got 26 or 29 different dialects spoken here. So it's hard to get the message out to everybody how important this is.
Yeah. And I think on that note, you know, Dr. O'Neill, maybe you can fill us in a little bit on the demographic issues. What we're seeing here across the country.
Hey, thanks for the opportunity, and I want to thank everybody else on the podcast for their contributions. What I'm going to talk about is these are general demographic patterns that are going to affect the fire service, and I want to begin by saying that this is information. It's neither good nor bad. It becomes either good or bad depending upon how we react to it. If we decide to take advantage of it, if we see this stuff coming and we do something about it, it's good. If we decide we're going to put our head in the sand and ignore it, well, we're going to get caught up in the tsunami we're going to become a victim of it as well, because we're going to be way behind the power curve in this whole process. I guess probably the place to begin is to talk about some of the construction that's going on. And I was just in a discussion with a friend of mine who teaches here, and he was talking about a statement that Underwriters Laboratories had on their on one of their online courses, and I've not been able to get to the course yet to take a look, but it doesn't surprise me that the building codes and the fire prevention codes are simply unable to keep up with the changes in construction in terms of both methods and material. They're using so many different plastics and things like that, and that we're not even able to keep up with what's going on. You and all of us are seeing more and more collapses in residential structure fires that were unheard of 10 or 15 years ago. I can't think of a time, at least in my own career as a firefighter, that we worried about building collapse in a residence. But now we see roofs coming in and floors collapsing. And that's one piece of it. The second piece on the big demographics, the great big capital D demographics, is the fact that the baby boomers are now becoming senior citizens. These were the folks that were born between 1946 and 1964. And the data are telling us that 92% of all the women who could have children in those years did, that a baby was born every 8 seconds for 18 straight years. And the average life expectancy right now for a baby boomer is 82 and a half years, but not before too long, it's going to be about 85. The beginning of the baby boom generation turned 62 last year in January 2008. Now, the end of the baby boom generation turns 85, which is the life expectancy, in the year 2050. So we've got about 41, 42 years of this bulge in the population. And let me describe what it is. They are 78 million strong out of a population of 300 million people, which means 26% of our population is in or beginning to go into the baby boom generation. I know I'm going to shock a lot of people. I'm going to break a lot of hearts. But Mick Jagger from the Rolling Stones is 66 years old. Sylvester Stallone, Rocky, Rambo, he's 63. And Dolly Parton and Farrah Fawcett are 63 years old. Now, there's something that we already know about seniors in our country. They're the high-risk group for fire, they're the high-risk group for accidents, and they're the high-demand group for EMS. This should not surprise anyone. The fire service is going to be facing more fire calls, more med calls, and there's going to be an increase in the number of people who are incapable of self-care, okay? They're changing their housing patterns. They're moving into condo-type buildings, apartment-type buildings, and they buy an apartment. They have what they call independent living. They have their own cooking facilities and things like that. And after a few years and their health begins to deteriorate, they go into assisted care. People come up and check on them every day, make sure they take their medication. And then, you know, 5 or 6 or 10 years, however long it takes, now you're in full nursing care. And this whole process goes on. Well, these buildings, not only are they concentrated with high demand EMS, high risk fire, and high risk accidents, but the fact is that the people who are there to help them in time of a disaster, a flood, an earthquake, a hurricane, a tsunami, whatever, are not going to be able to get in to help them when they need it. And these are the people least capable of self-care. So when the nurses and the nurses' aides and the social workers and everybody can't get into work because there's a road out, or there's a road flooded, or there's a blizzard, these people are all going to be calling 911 because they're going to be a day away from demise because there's some life-sustaining medication that they need or some help that they need. Universities, and I know this is something near and dear to Ed's heart, Ed Camo's heart, is universities are building these kinds of communities on their campus to attract alums back because campuses, of course, have a lot of activities. They have plays, they have concerts, they have libraries, they have courses that seniors can take for free and things like that. So those housing patterns are changing. And the other thing associated with universities, of course, is good medical care. Those senior citizens who are, again, high-risk fire, high-risk accident, high-demand EMS, are changing their housing patterns, and that will directly affect the fire and emergency services. The other demographics that we're seeing is a decline in volunteerism, and this is not just the volunteer fire service, but it's the social, religious, fraternal, and civic groups as well who are just experiencing a decline in participation. So, the volunteer fire departments are experiencing difficulties in many cases. And, the retention and recruitment is something that's been with us for a long time, but it's not going away. The other thing that we're seeing with the economy is something that Chief Rubin alluded to, and that is extended families living in one domicile. The son or a daughter loses their job, or the parents can't afford the taxes, so they're moving in and there are multiple families living in one residence designed for one family, and now we have two and three families. For those of us who are from the cities, that's not new. Every immigrant group goes through this thing, but now it is an economic pressure that's causing that. And concurrent with that is, of course, the abandoned housing that a lot of the cities are experiencing because of the mortgage foreclosures and people going bankrupt and people losing their jobs. And they're what they call upside down in their house. They owe more on the house than the house is worth. So they just walk away from it and they leave it vacant. And the all of those things combined are going to result in an increased demand for fire and emergency services because of the risk groups, the high-risk groups. There's going to be a decline in revenues for the cities, and we know that. And it's going to cause budget pressures on municipalities. So I think because of the decline in volunteers, because of the pressure on the budgets in the municipalities, you're going to see increasing pressures for local governments to regionalize, to cooperate. I mean, when you begin to ask yourself the question, let's take ourselves, take the fire and emergency services out of it, how many superintendents of schools do you need? How many assistant superintendents of schools do you need? How many heads of Department of Public Works and how many police chiefs and deputy police chiefs and fire departments, fire chiefs and chiefs of fire prevention and those kinds of things? So whereas where John Dean is from and Chief Rubin, and they're all in areas where there's a very, very strong focus on home rule in the Northeast Corridor especially. There's going to be, I think, at least economic pressures to increase the areas that these services are delivered in. So to conclude all of that, I mean, it sounds like it's all bad news, but I think the Fire Prevention Bureau, the fire prevention chief, the fire marshal, the fire chief, the union folks and the volunteer folks, if they begin to say, look, this train is coming down the track and we have a choice. We can get on this train and ride it into the future. We can stand at the railroad station and watch the train leave, or we can stand in front of the train and try to stop it. But it's coming. And so my recommendation is that we know it's coming. Let's do our best to try to take advantage of it.
Well, you brought up some great points that I want to get back to in a little bit.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
There are over 3,000 fire deaths annually. Tragically, most occur in the home, the place where people feel safest. The solution? Residential fire sprinkler systems. As sponsor of this podcast, the National Fire Sprinkler Association would like to offer everyone listening a complimentary copy of the second edition of its Residential Fire Sprinklers, a Step-by-Step Approach for Communities Guide, and new DVD, Look Up for Safety. Let's eradicate loss of life from fire. Together, we can make residential fire sprinkler protection a way of life.
And I think with that, I'd like to turn to Marshall O'Brocky to talk about what you're doing down there in Baltimore, because, you know, Baltimore is a heavily urban city, obviously, and I think over the past couple of years you've had some pretty good successes you can talk about.
Yeah, over the last 2 years we've reduced our fire deaths by 44%. We're still not where we want to be. The numbers are going in the right direction, but until they are zero, we have still have a lot of work to do. We're basically attacking fire prevention on all fronts. I think one of the reasons, the biggest driver of the numbers was that the fire causes, the fire deaths caused by smoking have dramatically been reduced, and I could attribute that to the state's passage of a fire safe cigarette. That's really kind of driven that down on that front. We also, in addition to legislative efforts, we're doing a lot more in community outreach, firefighters knocking on doors, and we're taking an all-hazards approach to fire prevention. You know, fire prevention is the biggest message, but we're talking about poisonings and slip, trip, and falls and everything, trying to increase that length of contact when we're going in and installing smoke alarms. We're trying to bolster more public-private partnerships. We have a great mobile safety center project with Johns Hopkins University. I mean, we're so lucky to have Johns Hopkins in our backyard. And the Mobile Safety Center is a huge steak-body truck that is the mock inside of a household we take around and run kids through, adults. We have a seniors program. So we run a lot of folks through that, and Hopkins is kind enough to track all the data for us. They are integral in securing grant money for us for that program. We also have an inspector-detector program with University of Maryland that gets us into all the preschools, so we're trying to hit as many levels as we can. But the big thing is educating our own people to the importance of public outreach. You know, in Baltimore City is an old fire department, and the emphasis really has been on fire suppression. So every time we do have a fatal fire, I respond, and I'll just talk with the guys, and I'll just simply say, you know, to the first and engine company, you know, did you guys have trouble getting here? And they usually say, no, we were here pretty quickly. Did you have trouble getting water? And no, we got a line right in service. And I'll say to the truck company, did you have any problems getting in or ventilating? No. And I'll say, you guys did everything right, and still these people died or this person died. You know, what could you have done differently? Well, you could have knocked on this guy's door yesterday and made sure they had working smoke alarms, you know, barred windows. A recent fire death we had were two Chinese Americans who were living over top the store they worked in. They had state-of-the-art burglar alarm. They had emergency security lighting. They had barred windows. They did not have one single smoke alarm. And it was a slow, smoldering fire. They had been given plenty of notice to get out, but they were trapped between the fire and the barred windows. So what we did was, and we talked about changing demographics. Dr. O'Neill has been talking about that. Our office of neighborhoods out of the mayor's office has been great. We have a Korean liaison, Latino liaison, and then different neighborhood liaisons. So we got out to the Asian community. I wrote an op-ed piece that was translated into Chinese, Korean, Vietnamese, and was put in these ethnic newspapers about the problem of, you know, people. There's always a tension between crime, you know, and security and fire safety. And I was trying to kind of strike a balance with these people who crime and security is number one on their list, and really fire safety, it doesn't even make it onto their radar screen. So, you know, I had that resource. We have a huge Latino community that's getting bigger all the time. So we're trying to get the word out there. We're trying to really hit on as many groups as we can. And like John Dean said, that it's the hard-to-reach groups are the ones that are suffering from the fires. And these are some of the approaches we're taking to these hard-to-reach communities. Next budget year, we actually, for the first time ever, are getting smoke alarms budgeted in our overall fire department budget. Years past, they've been donations, they've been grants. So that's a big step just symbolically to the rest of the fire department that, hey, you know, our chief takes fire prevention seriously. And we're switching to a 10-year lithium battery to give these smoke alarms staying power. Since 2000, we've installed almost 200,000 smoke alarms. And we track where we install them. And then we go back and they're gone. And you know, we're trying to find out what's happening to these smoke alarms. I mean, anecdotally, we think that when people are cooking and it goes off, they simply take them down. Or if the battery starts to wear out, they start to chirp, they take them down. Now, you know, that's just individual stories and kind of theory, but we don't really have any evidence to back that up. So, you know, we're going to start tracking these smoke alarms and seeing what is happening, why these smoke alarms, once we put them up, don't stay up. Mm-hmm. Residential sprinklers, we're going to try legislation. But for a community like Baltimore, like D.C., you know, we're about 95% built up. And to think of a retrofit legislation is really politically almost impossible in a city like this. But we're going to try to get one or two family dwellings, the residential sprinkler adopted. We're going to try to get a substantial rehab clause put in there. So if they do substantial rehab to the place, they have to sprinkler it. So we're really not leaving anything sort of off the table, ways of attacking this, and we're getting more aggressive.
Well, and it sounds like you're following a model that the UK is doing very successfully over there. For those of us there at the Vision 2020 conference last year, we had a presentation by Phil Hales who talked about how they're taking the all-hazards approach, just like you are, where they're going in and looking at holistically how a person is living and where the dangers are. And they've had a 50% reduction in fire deaths over there, and they're attributing it very directly to the same sort of program you're doing. So it sounds like very similar type of success.
Yeah, and I talked to Phil Shanneman from TriData, mm-hmm. and he says in Canada they're going to that model. And in fact, some legislators, I don't know if it was in Quebec or one of the provinces there, are saying the job of the fire department is to prevent fires. You will do fire prevention. You may do firefighting. Mm-hmm. So they're really putting that prevention model first, which culturally just isn't ingrained. It's not inculcated into your average, you know, firefighter right now, but we got to move in that direction.
And I think something I'd like to kind of throw out to all of you, really, is the whole issue of the changing demographic, and this kind of alluding to what Dr. O'Neill was just talking about. But I went to a workshop down in D.C. a couple months ago where demographics was the topic of discussion, and what the demographer was talking about is how the growth that we're going to see in population is really being driven by immigration. In the past, it's been driven by what they call natural growth, which is births minus deaths. You have more births, fewer deaths, you get growth. Well, now it's really swinging over to immigration, where the growth that we're going to see is people coming into our shores. And as a result, and a vast majority of these are going to be to the larger urban areas. That's just where they tend to migrate to, which I think is going to create a problem or an issue, just like John Dean was talking about, even up in Maine. You know, you've got all those different dialects in Portland, you know, and in Baltimore. You've got the different communities you were just talking about. And D.C., boy, I have to imagine that's a real melting pot there, Chief, in terms of different populations you have to deal with.
Absolutely is. We have folks from around the world here, and needless to say, we have, without a doubt, the most amount of consulates. So we do have a blended population that we're always trying to think about.
I mean, you know, Ray, you're kind of going through that there. Any ideas or suggestions on how you do reach out to these different populations with the same? It's the same message. It's just, I assume, has to be just packaged differently.
Like I said, we're trying to partner with the health department, with the mayor's office of neighborhoods, because these are entities, at least within the city, that are already out in the community, and they are in touch with the community leaders, and we really have to go through the community leaders. And we kind of are late learning this lesson. A couple years ago, we were out doing, you know, neighborhood sweeps for smoke alarms, and we were in a Latina area. Nobody would let us in, nobody. And then a little kid came up to us, and who was Latino, and said, "Would you like me to talk to them?" So then he went along with us and knocked on doors, and everybody let us in. Mm-hmm. You know, we talk about change, and either you help mold the change, help, you know, guide the change, or you become a victim of it. Right. And I think sometimes older fire departments are slower to change, but I think that's changing now. I think we're starting to see the need to be flexible and sort of fast on our feet and kind of go where the community goes.
Yeah, I specifically remember Phil Hales from the UK mentioning that they hire people from the different immigrant groups to work with the fire department, or if they can't find somebody, they partner with somebody, just like you're doing. You know, they find somebody from a Bangladeshi background, or, you know, so they can reach out to that community to get over those cultural issues you were just mentioning right there.
We've had some great success in D.C. with the media. And what I mean by that is Univision has an example where they have folks throughout the community that are well-respected, and they've partnered with us for our smoke detector installation program, and they come out with the dual language program. In fact, in the next few hours, I've got to go to a meeting related to that. And again, I think if folks reach a little bit outside their comfort zone, the media has so much to offer, I think, in this particular area at least, where it just makes good sense for them, and it makes them probably more valuable to the folks who don't speak English as a first language.
And as John was just talking about, too, we kind of have reached the low-hanging fruit, haven't we? We have to really start being creative and innovative in getting out to these different demographics, using these different partnerships to try to get into the community.
You know, I am, as we're speaking and having been involved in the Vision 2020, I keep getting reminded of Dr. O'Neill talking about traveling somewhere, and you can help me out on this, Dennis, I'm sure, and going to some country where it was mandated that a certain percent of the fire department had to be assigned to prevention activities. And as you mentioning UK and Canada, and obviously, you know, a whole change in the culture of the firehouse. Dennis, do you remember where that was?
John, I remember the story, and as I recall, it was a student floating through here. We have a number of foreign students who attend the National Fire Academy, and I'm scouring my brain right now, and I cannot remember. But I know
that what you're saying is right, and that that the focus has been on was on prevention, that they were required to do it.
Yeah. And it wasn't a wealthy country, as I recall, but it was a country that really had the right idea that, you know, you have to have people delivering the message, and it was a hard number. It was, you know, 10 or 20% of the total force had to be involved in this. Yeah.
But we also have to educate our lawmakers into the importance of prevention. You know, I'm sure Chief Rubin's budget was cut up in Baltimore. Our budget has been sliced and diced. And while every section of the fire department has lost money out of their budget, I actually gained about $100,000 in mine because I showed, you know, the lawmakers, you know, the city councilman, the deputy mayor, that it is cheaper to prevent fires than it is to fight them. And if you're going to cut in suppression, then you need to sort of mitigate that cut by putting more effort into prevention. Now, if you look at every document at the federal level written about the fire problem in this country, the Truman report in 47 or America Burning or America Burning Revisited, it all says prevention is the key. And everybody gives it lip service, but until you back it with dollars and human resources, it's just that, lip service.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's a huge success right there, that you managed to get an increase in your budget when everybody else was getting cut.
When you look at the cost, though, of the injuries, not just the fatalities, as the Chief Fire Marshal is mentioning, it's astronomical, and it just makes perfectly good sense to be able to show the lawmakers where we're at. And the comment earlier about the low-hanging fruit, I often wonder about that. When you read documentation by NFPA about homes having smoke detection and carbon monoxide protection, it should range somewhere close to roughly 50% in the community. And we just don't see that here in the district. The part that I thought was amazing is even the wealthier communities, we have some of the world's most incredible wealth, and we have some of the world's greatest poverty. When we go into homes that we expected to all have state-of-the-art monitored systems put in by outstanding, extraordinary companies, none of that seemed to be the case. So what we found pretty much across the board, without doing a research and a scientific study, about 60% of our homes are not protected, which is just frightening. I think the number actually is going down over time.
Wow, that's pretty. That's absolutely is outstanding.
One of the things that that the fire marshal and Chief Rubin have both said is referring to something that I suspect we all intuitively know, in that fire is pretty much is an economic issue as well as a sociological issue. I can probably count on the fingers in one hand the number of fires I fought in rich people houses. Versus the poor people houses, and it's not any one ethnic group. It's more an economic situation. It's an economic issue, and if you begin to look at it with the housing patterns and the overcrowding and the poor maintenance and all those things, all of those go back to an economic indicator. I was at a conference one time, and I said to the folks at the conference that your fire problem in a municipality is probably predictable by the number of social workers you have in the city or in the county. That'll tell you more about your fire problem than the fire trucks and the fire reports. And I don't know what the solution to that is, because the people on the lower economic scale struggle with so many different things. Education, they struggle with crime, with drugs and all of those things that live in those neighborhoods, that they have bars on their windows, all of those kinds of things. And getting the message across to them is very, very challenging. I mean, they have so many life-threatening things to worry about. It's not just fire.
The other side of it is, though, in response to that, and I think Chief O'Neill is right on track, we had three fatal fires in our city involving very, very wealthy folks. The first one happened in Upper Northwest two Christmas Eves ago, so I remember it vividly. A gentleman showed up who claimed to be the son of about an 85-year-old couple. Husband and wife both had perished in the fire. And he said something that I thought was just remarkable. He said that he had graduated from high school in 1970 and he remembers before he left home to start his military career and then his life outside of his home that they did test and check the smoke detectors, but the last time him and his parents talked about it was his 12th year of high school, which I guess is some 30-plus years ago. And I just found that amazing. And the family had wealth beyond measure and could have comforted. They could have been sprinklered, and I could go on. But I think it was just a lack of understanding. And the gentleman's crying in the front yard with us, holding our hand, describing the fact, for, you know, for a 9-volt battery, is both of his parents lay dead in their beds.
But as Dr. O'Neill said, I would say, you know, the number of fatal fires involving, you know, wealthy people or even middle class people, you know, are dwarfed by the number of poor people and economically, you know, challenged neighborhoods. And I try to tie in fire safety with a message of sort of empowerment. When I speak to these neighborhood groups, I say, listen, you can't control the crime in your neighborhood. You can't really control the trash and the grime in your neighborhood. The one thing you have the most total control over is fire safety, you know. So why don't you try to just, you know, just give it a thought. And it's cheap. It's not expensive. And, in fact, we'll help you with it. So, you know, you're empowered. I'm giving you guys the responsibility to take care of yourself. And like I said, unlike the crime, you do have control over this. And it is a problem.
And in looking at all these fires that I've been looking at over the years, I think anecdotally it's that same common thread. It's the lower socioeconomic groups where the fires and the fatalities are occurring. And it's easy for us to say, you know, tisk, tisk, if they had a smoke alarm, they'd be alive today. But also, if you look at the root cause, well, why didn't they have a smoke alarm, you know? And it is that sort of thing. They have a lot of pressure on them. They have a lot of issues to think about, to worry about. They're worried about putting food on the table. Is a smoke alarm necessarily on their radar screen? And I think, sadly, the answer is no. You know, and it is indeed a challenge to reach out to these groups and to talk to them and to reach them. And they're so transient, too. You know, they're just constantly moving from one place to the other that it's difficult to stay on top of them.
I just this is Dennis O'Neill. I just finished a book called Outliers. I'm not one who remembers all the authors to all these books, but the gentleman wrote a book called Blink. He wrote another book called Tipping Point. But in the Outliers book, he describes the phenomenon of lower economic status students. And they, you know, it's probably intuitively common knowledge that the folks in the lower end of the economic scale have a tougher time in the school system. But what they did was they measured them separately, middle class, upper, you know, financially well off, and poor. And when they measured the students between September and June, they all performed, retained about the same level. And in many cases, the rich kids did not as well as the middle class and then the poor. But it was the summertime, the 3 months between June and September, where the gaps occurred, where the middle class and the rich had summer camp and day, you know, activities, and the poor kids didn't. Well, you multiply that 3-month gap over 5 years or 10 years in school, and of course the gap widens and widens. But the point is, and I'm trying to make, is that given support, given the services, those data, if you extrapolate them into from the educational system into the behavior of fire, those data would suggest that if we continue to support the poor, that they will do just as well.
Well, we've been having a really great discussion here today on the problem of the significant multiple fatality fires that have been quite literally sweeping across the nation this January. And joining us today, we've had a really great panel of people talking. We've been talking with Chief Dennis Rubin from the Washington, D.C. Fire and Emergency Services, Maine State Fire Marshal, and NASFAM past President John Dean, Dr. Dennis O'Neill, who's the acting U.S. Fire Administrator, and Baltimore Fire Marshal Ray O'Brecky. Gentlemen, I really appreciate you all taking the time to join us today and talk about this. We've had just a tremendous amount of information here that's just, I think, will be of so much help to everybody out there in trying to address this problem. And certainly the positive example out of there of Baltimore with the reduction in the loss of life, I think, just speaks volumes to that. You know, we can address this problem, and we can try to solve it. So I thank you all for taking the time and joining us today here on Fire Marshal's Corner.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ed. What a great group. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us here on Fire Marshal's Corner on radio at firehouse.com. We've been talking about the significant multiple fatality fires. And there's going to be a lot more information available to you right here on the webpage. So if you scroll on down, you'll find some link to some great information. So thanks again for joining us.
Before leaving today's podcast, the National Fire Sprinkler Association invites you to click the banner ad link for free information about the advantages to providing residential fire sprinkler protection in your community and how to do it.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.